previous mission as to the climate change. One of the things that can be important when you look at any change of capitalism is there can be differences in products that are formed in different people, and that may be responsible for why some people have more of a problem discontinuing the products than others. And then also in terms of cancer, there is a difference in the metabolism of the compounds. So when you look at how effective are the nicotine replacement products, how the compound is metabolized makes a difference in how efficient these compounds are. Basically, what you're looking at there is the person rather than metabolizes the compound, they're not getting as much of it. So this is just to show you the metabolites that are formed. So the first one we're looking at is the oxidizer at the 5 position, and this just gives you an indication of how prevalent that raw metabolism is. So about 70 to 80% of the nicotine starts out with this as a raw metabolism. So here's your nicotine structure, the oxidizer at the 5 position, that could be eliminated if you do a double bond. Going to be carbonyl and by lactam ring. You can form glucuronides. Glucuronides usually considered to be polar compounds. These would be the compounds that are really excreted like in the urine. You oxidize the compound, the ring can open. You're looking at exposure to nicotine. Is the person really discontinued smoking? Or when you look at secondhand exposure to tobacco products, they usually don't look at measuring the nicotine itself because of its short half-life. Rather, they look at the exposure to the nicotine because it has a much longer half-life. So that would give you an indication of how much nicotine the person has been exposed to. Nicotine is compound that you have the lactam ring. Other site of oxidation, the 2' hydroxylation, is responsible for 10 to 15% of the metabolism. This is formed by your cytochrome 286, so there's a difference in how much the people metabolize the nicotine through this pathway. And this is the pathway that's responsible for the carcinogenic metabolites from nicotine. And they usually use the abbreviations rather than the chemical names of NNK and NA. NAL are the two compounds that are considered to be most carcinogenic of all the metabolites that are formed from nicotine. So here's your NNK. So you oxidize the 2 position. You open the ring, and then you form the N-nitrosyl compound. N-nitrosyl compounds, it's not showing here. You'll see some when you get into the chemotherapeutic agents. Some of the N-nitrosyl compounds can actually be used as aminoplastic agents or alkylating agents. So what you end up with here is you end up forming a methylcarbonamide that could alkylate DNA. Similar to a lot of compounds, when you look at metabolism, even if you form active metabolites, you usually have alternate pathways to get inactive compounds, and that's what's shown over here. So if you end up forming these acids, those will be polar compounds and eliminated. So just because you form a metabolite by oxidation at the 2 position doesn't automatically mean that you're going to form the carcinogenic compound or the same amount of the carcinogenic metabolites. This is showing the carcinogenic metabolites of future in NAL. You've got the alcohol metabolism would end up being similar. So in the years that you're looking at, you have this compound splitting off that can form the methyl group. And then the methyl group can add the DNA. It's not quite showing right as to what's happening. Again, alternate pathways, you form a glucuronide, it's polar, you end up these were the two compounds that were considered the carcinogenic ones, but if you oxidize and put it in an end position, you get non-carcinogenic compounds. So when you look at how much nicotine contributes to cancer, it depends on the specific metabolites that are formed. And don't expect you to know right about these pathways. Again, remember that nicotine is only one of the carcinogenic compounds in tobacco products. Things like the polycyclopyramidic hydrocarbons are probably responsible for more of the cancer-causing effects, some of your radioactive compounds, other nitrosyl compounds. So the cancer that's associated with smoking or tobacco use isn't only due to nicotine. We have one synthetic compound that's used to aid in the decrease in smoking. This is the compound that's used. Notice that we have a secondary amine, so it can be chlorinated. The secondary amine, the lipid soluble. They actually started out with, again, naturally spread compound and the chemical modification ended up with this compound. The compound is considered to be a partial agonist, meaning that both an agonist and an antagonist are the receptor. If you look at the agonist activity, it's anywhere from 30 to 60% comparable to the nicotine as an agonist on the receptors. When we look at the receptors in the CNS, these are the ones that are responsible for the addiction liability. But there's a lot of different types of receptors for acetylcholine in the CNS. We have 10 different categories of receptors, most of them are found in the CNS. This is the one that they think is responsible for the addiction liability because it ends up releasing dopamine, and dopamine is what gives the person the pleasure from the smoking. Because it causes the release of the dopamine, it's going to decrease the symptoms of the withdrawal, so it decreases the craving, it needs a cigarette, and it decreases the symptoms of the withdrawal. A person smokes in addition to using the compound to see the antagonist effects. So there's a limit as to how much dopamine can be released. In this particular compound, person sets a date when they want to stop smoking, and then they start taking the drug, and then they actually quit smoking like a week after this. So you want to get the effect of the drug before the person actually discontinues the nicotine. This is your target date, target quit date. This is a schematic that's trying to illustrate what would happen. So here's your nicotine interacting with the receptors, and ultimately what you end up doing is releasing the dopamine, and then it's the dopamine that is responsible for the pleasure, also the craving and the addiction. So the more nicotine a person has, the more dopamine will be released. Person quit smoking, you don't have the stimulation of the nicotinic receptors, you decrease the amount of dopamine, that's when you get the craving and withdrawal symptoms. So by using the drug, what you're doing is partially blocking these receptors, but you also see a partial agonist effect on the receptors. So you're having some dopamine relief, so that's why you don't see the withdrawal symptoms as much. But if a person had nicotine on top of this, again, the receptor blockade would prevent that from increasing the amount of dopamine that's released. It's considered more effective than the nicotine replacement products as far as effectiveness. But it doesn't matter what you use to quit smoking, they're not 100% effective. I don't know that I gave you these percentages. You don't have to worry about the percentages, but the main thing to remember is it's not 100% effective. This is using 1 milligram twice a day after 12 weeks. You can get 55% that are not smoking, but after a year, you're down to like 26%. You compare that to the nicotine products. Fewer people that quit smoking, 43%. So we have an increase in people that aren't smoking yet a month. And then after a year, when people were using nicotine replacement products, only 20% of them that actually quit smoking compared to the 26%. Not a big improvement, but it's used as higher than the replacement products. Compared to the nicotine replacement products, again, I don't think you have this one in your handout. Since you got the partial agonist effect, you're going to be decreasing the craving, withdrawal symptoms. Doesn't mean the compound doesn't have any side effects of its own, so it causes more nausea. One of the things that they've started worrying about with this particular drug is it causes neuropsychiatric symptoms. Things like depression, suicide thoughts. They actually have a warning that if you're an airline pilot, you can't use the product because of that. So it's not a high percentage, but it's something that they're looking at. You don't have that problem with the nicotine replacement products. The other thing that they've been working on are other compounds in the schizophrenics that are a group of people that usually have a very high percent that smoke, 80-90%. They're looking for compounds that would be agonists on the alpha-7 receptors, the separate receptor in the CNS. It's involved in the sensory gating. So, not on the market yet, but experimental compounds in different phases of testing. And the other thing is a vaccine, so that you get antibody production to the nicotine, so we keep it from interacting with the receptors. Again, there are clinical trials going on. This could be a more permanent type of way to get a person to quit smoking, because if you smoke and you don't get any effect from the nicotine, then the theory is that people would quit smoking. They're not going to get the release of the dopamine. The compounds that we've been covering up to now are the compounds that are the direct action compounds. Compounds that we're going to look at now are the indirect action compounds. We mentioned the acetylcholine esterase. It's being responsible for hydrolyzing the acetylcholine in the peripheral system. There is another enzyme that's referred to as the butyrylcholine esterase, pseudocholine esterase. Same enzymes, different names, that is found in different locations. It's not like in the synapse of the peripheral system, but you find it in the plasma. It is found in the CNS. It's associated with the glial cells. It gets its name because it has a more liberal substrate specificity compared to acetylcholine esterase. Acetylcholine esterase is going to be very size specific for hydrolyzing the compound. Butyrylcholine esterase is a negative 5. You can have a larger chain on the molecule and it'll still act. So, broader substrate specificity. As far as the normal function in the peripheral system, they think it's involved in hydrolysis of things like dietary esters, gets involved in the hydrolysis of some drug molecules. We'll see that when we get into compounds like succinylcholine. So if we inhibit the enzyme, we get an indirect action. It's the acetylcholine that interacts with the receptor. The importance here is that you're going to see both nicotinic and muscarinic effects because both are acted on by acetylcholine. So we're not going to have selectivity for one or the other. Shall any uses of the acetylcholinesterase inhibitors are listed, myasthenia gravis, and you want to increase the amount of acetylcholine that's binding to the receptors to increase muscle strength, so you're looking at the neuromuscular junction. When we get into the neuromuscular blocking agents, they'll be divided into depolarizing and non-depolarizing. You can use these compounds to reverse the non-depolarizing agents. And it's the acetylcholine that will do that. And at the neuromuscular junction. They can be used post-operative for urinary retention or to stimulate the GI tract. Can be used for glaucoma. Some of the products are used in the treatment of Alzheimer's disease. We'll cover those today. And then, not as drug molecules, but a lot of the compounds are used as insecticides. Probably, I think there's some reference that maybe there's about 1,000 different compounds that can be used. You see the cholinesterase, like the insects, are used for different products. And then the other area is as chemical warfare agents. I think you have this one in your handout. It's just showing you where the compounds are at. The main thing is to remember that the acetylcholine was normally hydrolyzed before it, to terminate its effect, so if we inhibit the acetylcholinesterase, we'll increase the amount of acetylcholine. We're looking more closely at the hydrolysis of acetylcholine. This is the enzyme, and the enzyme has the serine in its active site. The serine attacks the carbonyl and forms this tetrahedral transition state. Now, when acetylcholine is the substrate, the rate limiting step is to form the acetylated enzyme. You split off the choline. Then the acetylated enzyme is rapidly reactivated. We go back to the original enzyme, so we can come back and react with another molecule of acetylcholine and form the second product, the acetate. So the hydrolysis to regenerate the enzyme is very rapid. And we can hydrolyze acetylcholine normally in like millimeters to terminate its effect. We thought the binding of the acetylcholine to the acetylcholinesterase should be similar to what you saw when you interacted with the receptors. What they have found is that the interaction of the quaternary nitrogen involves a couple of aromatic groups, so these trication interactions are important. You do modification of the enzyme and remove these aromatic groups, then you won't bind the acetylcholine as well. This one also shows an ionic bond. In the past, they used to think it was just an ionic bond that was binding the quaternary nitrogen. But these aromatic groups are also important for orienting the molecule. This is the transition state that's shown. So we have the serine covalently attached to where the carbonyl was, and then the oxygen on the carbonyl is stabilized by hydrogen binding. Serines are not usually real reactive. So to activate the serine, there's referred to as a charge relay network or triad. So you have the serine, and you have a histidine residue that picks up the hydrogen was on the serine, and then the charge is transferred to a glutamate residue. So this is why this particular serine is so reactive. When we look at the acetylcholinesterase inhibitors in general, we don't go around interacting with all the different serines that are present on proteins and enzymes. You don't have that charge relay activation of the serine, you won't interact. And this is the one that's, again, in your notes, again, this cation and pi interaction involving the tryptophan and the phenylalanine is considered to be important for binding the positive charge on the nitrogen. This is shown with the negative charge, but again, it's not just a simple ionic bond. This is the carbon that was a carbonyl. So again, when the serine is attacking, you have the oxygen attacking this carbon. The oxygen will be stabilized. So again, the removal of the hydrogen from the serine is through a system that involves the histidine and the glutamine. I don't know, did I give you this one or not? I won't reproduce it for you, but it's showing you the same thing. There's that system with the serine, the histidine, and the glutamate. So the serine attacks the carbonyl. You form the covalent bond. The oxygen here then was stabilized by hydrogen binding. When these electrons come in, you split off the side chain. That picks up the hydrogen that the histidine picked up. So that's your rate limiting step when you're hydrolyzing the acetyl-CoA to split off the first product. Here's your CoA being produced. You have the acetylated enzyme. The next step is to hydrolyze that so you have water being activated, attacks the carbon, and now you end up regenerating the enzyme, splitting off the enzyme, and you form your second product, the acetate. This is another one that's showing exactly the same thing, so I'm not going to go through it. But again, main thing here that you should be picking up is the rate limiting step, splitting off the first product, the whole, forming the acetylated enzyme. When you're hydrolyzing acetyl-CoA. The hydrolysis to regenerate the enzyme again is very rapid. Rate for hydrolyzing acetyl-CoA is like about 150 milliseconds. I'll give you copies of these two. I found another source that's showing the diagrams and how they look different. So depending on, some of those are a little busy. So the attraction is through the nitrogen that places the ester over the serine to split off the products. We're going to divide the acetylcholinesterase inhibitors into two categories. We have what's referred to as reversible inhibitors. These are, in many cases, carbamate molecules. If it's a carbamate, it actually acts as a substrate. So it binds in place of the acetylcholine. You form an acetylated enzyme, which is usually a carbamate that you're putting on there rather than an ester. Carbamates are more stable to hydrolysis than esters. You can regenerate the enzyme by hydrolysis. So those are referred to as your classical reversible inhibitors, compounds that act as a substrate. We'll have other compounds that combine but they don't act as a substrate. Those are referred to as the non-classical inhibitors. We have a carbamate in the acetylcholine esterase inhibitor. The inhibited enzyme is going to be a carbamate. So notice instead of having an ester, we've got a nitrogen here. So this is the carbamylated enzyme. It can be regenerated by hydrolysis. So we'll split off the carbamic acid and we'll regenerate the enzyme. When we look at the individual products, they can differ in how fast they interact with the enzyme. And there you're looking at, you remember acetylcholine, basically you don't have bulky groups by the ester. So the less size you have there, the more rapidly compound can interact with the enzyme. So just carbamic acid, maybe these are both hydrogens, will be more rapid than if you add one methyl, which is more active than if you add two methyls. So the more substituted the carbamate is, the slower the nitrogen reaction. What's more important is how fast can you regenerate the enzyme, the hydrolysis step. In the case of the carbamylated enzymes, that is the rate-limiting step, not the formation of the carbamylated enzyme, but rather the regeneration, the hydrolysis step. So K3 becomes rate-limiting instead of K2. If you just compare the unsubstituted compound, the carbamic acid or the hydrogens, versus having a methyl, if you have an acetylcholine, it's like 10 to the 7th times slower. Adding just one methyl to the carbamate gives you an enzyme that will be inhibited for like 15 minutes. So rate of hydrolysis is much slower. Yeah. Acetylated enzyme, matter of milliseconds, because of the millisecond here. Most of the compounds that are going to be inhibitors will have an aromatic ring on the molecule. They have higher affinity for the enzyme than compounds that just have alkyl groups. If you look at KIs of 10 to the minus 8, 10 to the minus 1 versus alkyl groups of 10 to the minus 5. Greg would say it's 1,000 times higher affinity. This would be 10,000 times higher affinity. So when you look at compounds that are used, they're going to have the aromatic ring. The aromatic rings are better leaving groups than the alkyl groups to give. So that's why they have higher affinity. Again, I know they're CPS activated yet, but if you were looking at these two compounds, which one would have the highest affinity for the acetylcholine esterase?
D.
Because this is an aromatic system. Okay, if we were looking for the longest duration of inhibition, then we've got three choices. A, B, or A and B being equal. How many think A? How many think B? And how many think they're equal? You're going to form the carbamylated enzyme. So here you have the methyl group on the nitrogen. So it's going to be harder to regenerate the enzyme compared to this one, which just had hydrogens. So the more substitution you put on the nitrogen, the slower the reactivation will be, the regeneration. Now, if I put both hydrogens on here, then they would be equal because you form exactly the same carbamylated enzyme. The compound of just a hydrogen here isn't a commercial product, but it could be put on the test question as a hydrogen. So you've got to remember the reaction form of the inhibited enzyme, but then also to regenerate. So you look at what's the carbamylated enzyme look like after it's the enzyme is inhibited. If that comes home with the price of staking, it's a natural product store, the one that was discovered a long time ago. We do have an aromatic system, so remember with KR values, the lower the number, the more potent the compound is. So 10 to the minus 9 is more potent than something that's like 10 to the minus 10. The lower the number, the more potent the compound is. One of the things that will be important about this compound is we don't have the ternary nitrogen. These are tertiary amines. So this compound is capable of getting into the CNS. When we look at other compounds that have quaternary nitrogens, they won't get into the CNS, so they won't be able to regenerate the enzyme there. Compound can undergo degradation. You can hydrolyze it, so you hydrolyze the carbamate. You form the compound with the phenol group, and then this undergoes oxidation. What's important here is it's not going to be stable to heat or light, so you can't sterilize it to heat. And you also can't tell if it's been degraded. This compound has a color. So they usually add an antioxidant, like the sulfite or ascorbate, to prevent the formation of the color. But just because you prevented the formation of the color doesn't mean that the drug is still intact, because this compound is inactive. So the hydrolysis may still have occurred, even if you don't see the color. So the sulfite and the ascorbic acid don't prevent this first step, the hydrolysis. They only prevent the second step, forming the red product. To be used in the treatment of glaucoma, and again, because this compound can get into the CNS, it's the compound that's used in cases of systemic toxicity from compounds that have anticholinergic activity. And when we get into other categories of drugs, there's a lot of compounds that have this anticholinergic activity as one of the components, particularly when you're looking at overdoses. One of the important categories are your tricyclic antidepressants. Again, there's a lot of drugs that have anticholinergic side effects. So if you want to reverse those, increase the amount of acetylcholine, then you use the physostigmine. Another question on duration. Again, you've got two drugs, and then are they equal to one another? So how many think A would have the longest duration? How many think B would have the longest duration? And then how many think they'd be equal? The longest duration would be this one, because now you have two methyl groups on the carbamate. So it's going to be harder to regenerate the carbamylated enzyme than with this compound, which only had one methyl. So again, more substitution on the nitrogens, the harder it is to regenerate the enzyme. Compound was neostigmine. One of the clues when we're looking at names is to look at what kind of salt you have. Like here you have a bromide salt, similar to like a chloride salt. It's got a minus charge on it, so the drug has to have a plus charge. It tells you that you start out with a quaternary nitrogen in the molecule. If you see something like a hydrochloride salt or a nitrate or a sulfate, those are acids that have hydrogens, so then it indicates that you've got a primary, secondary, tertiary amine, but something where you have the hydrogen being transferred to the molecule. If you look at it, you can see a resemblance to acetylcholine. If you look at this plus charge, and then the distance to where the carbamate is considered to be similar to placing the molecule on the enzyme? And because of the two methyls, it's more stable and longer acting than the physostigmine. Carbamates in general are going to be metabolized by hydrolysis. Doesn't have to be by the acetylcholinesterase molecule. There are other enzymes, like in the liver, plasmacholinesterases that can carry out the hydrolysis. So you can hydrolyze the carbamate to terminate the effect. Compound can be used orally, the myasthenia gravis, when you're trying to increase the amount of acetylcholine at the neuromuscular juncture. You can use it to reverse the non-depolarizing neuromuscular blocking agents. Or it can be used like post-operative for urinary retention or to stimulate the GI tract. Notice you're looking at both nicotinic and muscarinic effects. This one would be muscarinic. These others are nicotinic. But again, it's acetylcholine that's producing the effect. Another CPS question. We looked at the rate limiting step and we used the neostigmine, so the association with the enzyme, carbamylation, and the hydrolysis. How many can A, how many can B, and how many can C? So with any of these carbamates, the rate limiting step for the inhibition will be how fast can we regenerate the enzyme, so the hydrolysis. The rivastigmine is very similar to the previous compound. The difference here is the nitrogen is in the aromatic ring, and it has the methyl, so it's here. Quaternary nitrogen. Yeah, it's considered to be more stable and longer acting. Metabolism, again, it's a carbamate, think in terms of hydrolysis. Compound can be used orally, myasthenia gravis. Again, because of the quaternary nitrogen, they don't get into the CNS, so you don't have to worry about the interacting with the enzyme there. And again, to reverse the non-depolarizing neuromuscular blocking agents. Another question that came in at CBS, we looked at the effect of pH on the inhibition of the enzyme. Which one would be effective? Is that A, B, or are they both effective or not effective? So how many think A? How many think B? And how many think they're equal? We're going to look at the effect of pH. We're going to look at changing the ionization. This is a quaternary nitrogen, so pH isn't going to affect its ionization. This one, we had two nitrogens. So pH will affect the protonation. And when the compound interacts with the enzyme, we assume we want a positive charge. And actually, the quaternary nitrogen and the acetylcholine interacted. So therefore, its action would be affected by pH. And that's shown here. Neostigmine was a quaternary nitrogen. So it doesn't matter what the pH is. It still has a plus charge on it. So the inhibition percent doesn't change with pH. If the physostigmine didn't have it at a lower pH, that's when the compound could be propagated, carry the plus charge, interact with the enzyme. And as you increase the pH, you lose that ionization, so now it's not associated with the enzyme, and you lose the activity. We have a couple of other compounds that are usually put into the reversible category. This first one looks like two molecules of neostigmine that have been joined by this long hydrocarbon chain. This would be similar to one molecule of neostigmine. The should be similar to your second molecule of the real stigmate. And you've got 10 carbons that are holding them together. Compounds used for glaucoma. Compound interacts with the acetylcholine and then you very slowly regenerate the enzyme. It's essentially similar to an irreversible inhibitor as far as duration. But because it's a carbamate, which is really included with the reversible ones. When it takes this long to regenerate the enzyme, essentially what you're doing is synthesizing a new enzyme instead to reverse the effect of the compound. And the other compound that's not a carbamate, but which is similar, shown here, you can again think of this as kind of like if you had a carbamate, but it's not a carbamate because you've got two of them joined together next to one another. This one actually is not hydrolyzed by the acetylcholine esterase enzyme. It's used in the treatment of myasthenia gravis. You have two quaternary nitrogens on the molecule, so that can interfere with the ureter absorption in the GI tract. It is used orally. You have to individualize the dose to differ. And then the last compound that's a reversible compound is a very short one until we get into compounds for Alzheimer's. But interphonium has the quaternary nitrogen, but it doesn't have a carbamate. So you just have this phenolic group that would be placed similar to where the oxygen would be in the acetylcholine. It's used as a diagnostic agent. One of the problems that the person has myasthenia gravis, it's hard to tell if they have too much or too little acetylcholine because you get similar type of symptoms. So when you use the compound, it inhibits acetylcholine esterase, you increase acetylcholine, you increase muscle strength, and that would say they don't have enough. If it makes the condition worse, then you're saying that they have too much and you want to decrease whatever age they're on. So, too much or too little can be a problem. And this is a very short-acting compound. You notice its duration. It's a matter of minutes. So you're not going to have a long duration. You don't want a long duration when you're using a diagnostic. It can also be used to reverse non-depolarizing neuromuscular blockage. So again, it's a very short-acting compound. Covalent bond transition state, so it can easily dissociate from the enzyme. One compound that's a carbamate that's used as an insecticide is shown here. Notice this compound doesn't have a nitrogen on it to direct it to the acetylcholine esterase. Is used on kind of plants, or you can use it in whole foods and ticks on pets. You want a lipid-soluble compound when you're trying to have an insecticide because you want it to be able to get into the insect. But you also have to be careful in terms of absorption. Persons applying it to a pet because it is a lipid-soluble compound and it can be absorbed. That's would like to read the paper.